But we'll begin with a writer who made a name for himself with young adult fiction. John Marsden has won plenty of awards and sold millions of books, especially for his Tomorrow series, Tomorrow When the War Began, and so on. Now he has written his first novel for adults, South of Darkness, set at the end of the 18th century. It's the story of a poor boy named Barnaby Fletch, who commits a crime and is transported to Botany Bay. Why this story and this period then? John Marsden spoke to Michael Cathcart during the week on Books and Arts Daily, who wondered what the writer listens for when deciding on a new book project.
Kind of voice, but also energy. I think probably energy more than anything. There's got to be a kind of momentum and something alive about the book. There's an energy that some books seem to have, which is immediately engaging. That's what I'm always striving for.
So you feel like you've got the book you've got a good chance that you've got a book. If you've got the sort of pace and energy right, you can feel it really early on. Getting the voice, I suppose that's the mystery, because you can wrestle around, you think I've got a great topic, but if you can't find the... If you don't know whether this is a big, epic, slow-moving book or whether it's a fast, witty book, I guess you're in trouble.
P.G. Wodehouse said that every sentence should have entertainment value. And if you put a blindfold on and randomly pointed to a sentence in any of his books, I think you would find it probably does have entertainment value. He seemed incapable of writing a boring sentence. And so that would be something I'd aspire to. It's pretty hard to achieve. But he did it in a way which is almost indefinable. It's very hard to identify how he did it, but he did seem to have that that secret.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the story. So Barnaby Fletch is the name of this young bloke. So tell us about him.
Well, he's a street kid and struggling to survive. And as he comments at one stage in the book, he's not unaccustomed to seeing children who haven't made it, like there are bodies sometimes in the slums of London in the late 18th century, but he somehow survives. I mean, there's always a few who kind of manage to, by luck or good management, get through, and he survives, and he desires a better life and forms the intention of committing a crime so he can be transported to New South Wales.
He doesn't quite, yes. There's a nice twist in that, but we won't go into that. Basically, he gets what he wants, let's say. He ends up going to New South Wales.
Initially, yeah, in the short term.
Yeah. So the book's really in three parts. There's the time in London. Then there's quite a long period on the voyage out. You've given a lot of space to the voyage. And then there's something about his adventures in the colonies, and he's soon on the run, and he lives for a stretch with the Aborigines. Well, what did Barnaby expect would be his fate in New South Wales? I mean, why does he want to come to Botany Bay? Because, you know, presumably one version of Botany Bay is that it's a terrible place to end up.
Yeah, his life is so narrow, his experiences of the world are so limited that he has no idea that there's anything outside London, and the idea that there are places with different climates, for example, comes as quite a shock to him. And when someone says, do you know where New South Wales is, he says, well, I guess it's in Wales. And they laugh at him, but that's how limited his understanding is. So he forms this utopian image of a place where there'll be perpetual sunshine and people can kind of walk through forests and have space, infinite space.
Can we talk about who the convicts were? Because there's a long-running debate. It's still going, really, between historians who think that the convicts were hardened criminals and those who see them as ordinary people who were doing what they could to survive, you know, in a brutal age where market forces were the only law.
Yeah, I was always a little sceptical, even as a child, about the idea that someone who stole a handkerchief would be transported for 14 years and that that would be the only crime they'd committed. I just found that a little implausible. And I think the common or popular view that people were trying to just maybe steal a loaf of bread to keep the family from starvation, it's an attractive myth, but I'm a bit of a disbeliever. I think it's more likely that these people were often recalcitrant criminals who the local magistrate was very keen to get rid of. And so transportation was a convenient method for achieving that. But also, if you could get them convicted of any crime, then that would give you the justification for sending them away. So I'm sure there were people who were genuinely maltreated, but I think a lot of them were probably pretty hardcore.
Now, I was a bit puzzled about why Barnaby was so well-spoken, why you made him so posh. For a boy who lived on the streets, he does seem terribly articulate. He quotes Shakespeare and Pilgrim's Progress. Well, he reads Pilgrim's Progress in the course of the book and absorbs quotations. At one stage, he's quoting Alexander Pope.
Yeah, that's right. But the book is written in hindsight, so he's reflecting as an older person on his childhood, and it's clear from various references in the book that he's actually received quite a good education as he got older. Didn't happen when he was living on the streets, but he was fortunate enough to fall into good company occasionally, and he did pick up quite a decent education.
And did you feel you needed that as a device, because you needed an articulate storyteller rather than an inarticulate?
Yeah, definitely. I wouldn't be interested in writing in a very sort of simplistic voice. I love language too much. I think I just love the sound of words, and I love using the vocabulary of the 18th century and playing with words. I'd find it too frustrating to restrict myself.
The topic of homosexuality comes up a couple of times. You don't use that term because it wasn't invented back then. It didn't come into use until 100 years later. The sodomy is the term you use. What part do you think sex between men played in the early colony?
I'm sure it was a very powerful part of their lives. It's inevitable. It's impossible to believe that that wouldn't be the case. And the only book or writer I know who's confronted it was such a long time ago, and that was for the term of his natural life, where Marcus Clarke was brave enough to explore that very topic. And I can't imagine what kind of trouble he got into and what kind of scandal he created by referring to it. But he does confront it quite unflinchingly in some pretty horrific descriptions of life at Port Arthur.
Yeah.
So that was, I don't know, 1850 or something that was published. And I'm sure people have kind of touched upon it since, but I don't think it's ever been really explored in any depth. But in that all-male society, then it's inevitable that that would have flourished, and that younger boys would have been picked on. They would have been targeted.
Yeah, well, that's the issue. It's not that there's something wrong with homosexuality, but that the preying on young boys was a terrible thing. Can we talk about the Aborigines? Because what happens to this young man is he ends up living with the Aborigines. They're in the Blue Mountains, are they? Is that the idea?
Right. Yeah, on the edge of the Blue Mountains.
Now, I was interested in how you'd research this and a particular choice you made. You say you relied particularly on a book written by Giza Roheim, who's a fascinating guy. He's a Hungarian psychoanalyst who visited Hermannsburg Mission in the 1920s, in 1929. He's there for 9 months. But I didn't really understand why you would use a book that was written in the 1920s, set in a research on Central Australia, to write about Aborigines who lived on the coast so much earlier. Why did you make that choice?
Well, because there's so little first-hand material available that comes from a really trained observer and someone with the depth of intelligence that he brought to it. So that psychoanalytical approach appeals to me because I think it gets closer to the truth than any other approach.
But they are a different people living in a different place 100 years later.
But they are also people who'd had little or no contact with white culture. And so I took that to be a kind of exemplar for the way indigenous people lived across Australia in that era. And that's a bit of a jump, but I think it's fair to assume that behaviours and traits would have been common to different tribal groups.
You said recently that you'd grown quite a little tired of the young adult market or the genre, that too many adults have invaded the territory with motives that might have more to do with their own immaturity than anything else. You're moving away from the area that really has made you famous, are you?
It's not really a deliberate choice, but there's something in me which shrinks a little when I see all these young adult titles in bookshops now, and they tend to all have the same look and the same style and the same marketing kind of tactics, and they often seem to be written quite cynically and marketed very cynically, and they seem to be often middle-aged people trying to achieve the voice of a 16-year-old who's always kind of funky and hip and cool or whatever the current words are, and it just doesn't seem quite true. In my own defense, I should say that I didn't ever try to do that in my books, really. I tried to use language which was true and which would ring true for a teenager, but they weren't teenagers who were out to show their funkiness.
There's a longer version of that interview with John Marsden available online. His new book, South of Darkness, is published by Macmillan.